Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how a rivalry between two pioneers of the birth control movement may have impacted its progress, and taking a Frank Lloyd Wright design with you on the road. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I certainly can't imagine us not asking. Arizonans paid nearly $200 million for the putting up that container wall and then taking it down and storing, and I think we deserve some of those funds back.
I believe these are, auxiliary to this, and I don't believe there's a direct conflict on this, and so I think we have a great shot at winning these.
But I treat people fairly. I treat people respectfully. I'm not mad at them when they engage in misconduct. We just hold them accountable.
This is especially important for law enforcement to be able to ensure that they're able to step in when necessary to be able to seize pets when needed, as well as for the Arizona Humane Society to ensure that pet owners have appropriate education.
We are arguing that the secretary, who's a totally unelected executive agent, is using legislative power to pick and choose which laws she wants to disregard with respect to border wall construction.
These are two of the businesses that most persistently and recklessly sell tobacco, nicotine products, to underage kids in Arizona.
And with me to talk about a new arrangement to fund Democratic campaigns in Arizona, an Arizona senator heading to the Iowa State Fair, and more, our former state school superintendent Jaime Molera of the firm Molera Alvarez. Good morning, Jaime.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And former congressional staffer and attorney Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to both of you. So, Roy, let me start with you talking about the Copper State victory. This is an arrangement that is funneling money and resources through the Navajo County Democratic Party in response to, I think, a lot of state Democrats have concerns about the state of the state party. How well or not well do you expect this to work?
I think it's going to work very well. I mean, so this is going to be the coordinated campaign for all of the Democrats. And I think the Democrats know how important next year is with all three Democratic statewide officials up for re-election, with a legislature up for grabs, with two competitive congressional districts. And it's very necessary to have a robust and sophisticated and well-funded coordinated campaign. That's one of the sort of essential things. And this, Copper State victory infrastructure is going to ensure that that occurs. Now, will this infrastructure work with the state Democratic Party? I'm sure it will in some aspects. You know, obviously there's a lot of issues going on over there with the state party and the chairman. And, obviously the state committee is going to probably have a say on his future going forward. But either way, this coordinated campaign is going to ensure that the Democrats have what they need to win next year.
In a perfect world, like, is this the kind of thing that Democrats would like to have avoided if they could have?
Well, I mean, there's always something that could be better, right, with political campaigns, certainly. I mean, we have seen this approach before in Arizona on the Republican side. We've seen Senator McCain do that when he was up for re-election. We've seen Governor Ducey do this, a similar thing when he was up for re-election. So, and those campaigns worked. They got reelected. Generally speaking, the Republicans did well those cycles. So I don't think it's going to be any different for the Democrats this time and for Governor Hobbs and Fontes and Mays.
So, Jaime, Roy mentioned the Republican Party doing this, most notably through the Yuma County Republican Party. It was not a permanent thing. I mean, the state Republican Party seems to have, they have a new chair now, and, they seem to be able to handle what they need to be doing. What to you does this say sort of about the state of the Arizona Democratic Party?
Well, I was going to say, I haven't seen this kind of chaos and dysfunction since the Republican Party 4 years ago.
It's like a pendulum, just back and forth.
That's right. As Roy said, these are the kinds of things that tend to happen, but the leadership is going to want to make sure that they control the dollars in a way that they think is most effective. And certainly the state party right now, I think there's no confidence that they're able to do that, just like there was with the Republicans. But the thing that I found amusing when they announced they're going to be going through the Navajo County Democrat Party it was all this laudatory talk about how, yeah, they're so organized and that county has that infrastructure that we can use. They're not going to make one decision on how $1 gets spent. It's going to be the Democratic operatives that are controlled by the state leadership on how they're going to drive that money. They're just using it as a conduit so that they can park their money and then figure out how to utilize it in the next election cycle.
Do you see, I mean, do you see, other than sort of the mechanism for doing this, I guess maybe sort of in the background, in the philosophy, do you see parallels between when the Republican Party did something similar to
this? Of course, very similar, because it was the exact same thing. When Kelly Ward was the chairman and it was very acrimonious and they had a lot of dysfunction and they couldn't raise money. So the leadership said, you know what, we're just going to do it our own. Governor Ducey basically had their own organization, but they controlled it. And so that's the key of this thing, is that who controls the dollars and how do they want it expended? And also, one of the other big things is, what races will they consider to be the ones that they want to put their money into?
Mm.
So that's going to be interesting. But again, that's where whoever has the dollars tends to control how it gets spent.
Roy, is this the kind of thing that in a perfect world, and we've heard from the Navajo County Democratic Party chair saying, look, we're going to do this now by 2028 when it's a presidential year. Ideally, the state party is better able to handle that kind of thing. In a perfect world for Democrats, is this a temporary arrangement?
It might be. And, you know, Jaime, it's funny. You don't believe something you saw in a press release? I guess not. But no, I agree with a lot of what Jaime said. I mean, a lot of this is going to be about, you know, making sure, again, that the fundraising is done correctly. You know, the funds are coming in and, again, that they're being spent correctly. And when you have, you know, Senator Kelly, Senator Gallego, Governor Hobbs, you know, three people who have won very tough elections in a very tough state for Democrats, mm-hmm. you know, as a Democrat, I would say, okay, it is them and their operations and their consultants that probably know best when it comes to like how this money should be spent and how we should go forward to put Democrats in the best position to win next year. So, you know, I think, you know, whether it's this time through Copper State, whether in 2028 it's through the state Democratic Party, either way, I think I feel confident that the people that are going to make the decisions, strategic decisions, and do the fundraising are going to be people that have won, have a track record of winning, and will win again.
You know, it's interesting,
yeah,
though,
ahead.
This is the one thing that I've seen that has brought Governor Hobbs, Secretary Fuentes, and Attorney General Mays together. Boy, they look like a team. They look like a happy team, like a happy family, which you never really see very often.
It's like sort of the common enemy thing, right?
Right.
You need, that can bring people together. Roy, let me stick with you on CD7. This is the special election coming up on Tuesday to replace the late Congressman Raul Grijalva. It seems as though on the Democratic side, and this is a pretty heavily Democratic district, I mean, the conventional wisdom is that whoever wins the Democratic primary will most likely win this seat. It seems like at this point it's a three-person race between Adelita Grijalva, Congressman Grijalva's daughter, former state lawmaker Daniel Hernandez, and Deja Fox. Is that sort of what you're hearing as well?
It, totally. I mean, that's the field, right? I mean, there's some other candidates, but they're not major candidates. I think the conventional wisdom right now from the people that I talk to is that Adelita is the clear favorite to win next week. I think what's maybe surprising right now to a lot of people is when people are sort of predicting who's going to finish second, a lot of folks now are saying it's going to be Deja Fox, which a lot of people wouldn't have said, you know, a month ago or whatever, since she's a brand new candidate. So if we end up, you know, with a race that results in Adelita winning the primary and then Deja Fox second and Daniel Hernandez third, I think that second and third slot is going to be pretty surprising. Because I think Deja Fox, in some sense, you know, and there's been some articles in The Republic about her, from the social
and
media perspective,
too, yeah.
You know, she's gotten some momentum. Ultimately, it's not going to be enough, I think, to beat Adelita. Adelita's going to be the next congresswoman. But it is something, and it's notable, I think.
What does that do, I guess, you know, for Democratic politics in Southern Arizona? Because Daniel Hernandez he obviously was a state lawmaker himself. Both his sisters are state lawmakers, so that, you know, and they're a pretty well-known political family in Southern Arizona. Right. To have, if, as Roy suggests, maybe he comes in third and Deja Fox, who's young and, you know, very strong social media presence, like, what does that do? Does that change the sort of the balance of Democratic political power in Southern Arizona at all?
I don't think so. I think what you're seeing is a trend that's happening within the Democratic Party. I mean, Deja Fox has been compared to AOC and young, very progressive. And that's been a trend of the party. And that's one of the reasons, in my opinion, I think they're having some difficulty, especially in the more competitive areas where those kinds of candidates don't tend to do well. Now, certainly I agree with Roy that District 7 is going to be a Democrat district. I mean, it's just so heavily, unless something majorly crazy happens. Grijalva should win that election. But the reason I think that is that as of right now, about 20% of folks have already voted in the early ballot.
Yeah.
So 20%, that's a pretty good turnout for a special election. So the higher that is, I think the more that indicates that Grijalva and those kinds of machines that tend to know how to get out the vote and they're more sophisticated about that tend to do better. I'm a little surprised that Daniel Hernandez has fallen to a pretty distant third. So because he's raised the most money. He's already raised over $1 million.
Right.
So it's interesting to see how that's going to play out, but it really should be because of Grijalva and her name. And also she has a very strong connection with the progressive wing. I think that's a big help to her.
Obviously, whoever wins this is going to have to run again in the regular election next year. Will there be anything in the results that might be tea leaves to read for 2026?
Well, again, if Deja Fox does better than expected and it's much closer, then that shows that there is that element of the Democratic Party that really likes that and really wants to push that hard progressive policies. And I think that big picture tends to bode well better for Republicans, because I think that was one of the key points in 2024, and I think why Republicans did so well. So it'll be interesting to see. But I think the Democrats are understanding that they have to do a better job of reaching out to what was their traditional base, which is the blue-collar workers, union workers, and get back to the economic issues instead of the social policy issues.
Roy, let me ask you about somebody for whom you used to work, U.S. Senator Ruben Gallego. He announced this week he'll be going to the Iowa State Fair. I assume he'll be excited to try all the fried food and the corn maze and the butter sculptures and all. But I also assume that's not the reason he's going.
He's going for the fried PB&J, I'm sure.
As one would.
As one would. You know, I think, obviously Senator Gallego is a unique voice, a prominent voice. I think one of the sort of biggest leaders now, the National Democratic Party, as well as obviously Arizona. And I think he's going to go to Iowa and share his perspective, both as someone who won an incredibly difficult Senate race in a difficult state, but also to talk about some of the things, you know, coming from a working class background, a military background, the kind of messaging, I think, that is going to be very useful and effective for Democrats going forward. I mean, we just talked about in the prior segment about, you know, depending on where you're running, you have to change your message. You know, obviously a message in a deep, you know, blue district might be different than what you do nationally or statewide. And I think he's demonstrated the ability to do kind of it all. And so I think that that's what he's going to do in Iowa. And I also think, I mean, obviously we're going to maybe talk about the big, beautiful bill, but like he's going to be there to talk about the devastating effects of that from his perspective on people nationally and, of course, in Arizona.
Jaime, is it fair to assume that this trip will also continue the talk and the prognostication about whether or not Senator Gallego might be looking to run for president in a few years?
Well, I always remember there's an old saying that when somebody becomes a United States senator, when they wake up in the morning, they look in the mirror, they see the presidential seal looking back at them. So, but I think that Senator Gallego and the way he ran his campaign in Arizona really should be a model, and Republicans should be worried about those kinds of candidates. I just don't see that happening right now. I think the Democratic Party, as I talked about earlier, has been going more and more to the progressive wing. However, if he's able to come across as that person that can articulate why they need to talk about the working class and talk about things that people really care about, as opposed to, again, those kinds of social issues that tend to dominate the Democratic discussions, then he could be a formidable candidate. That's for sure.
Is this the kind of thing where, Jaime, as you alluded to, and Roy, you talked about it too, sort of getting this message out where even if he has not said, I'm definitely not running for president, but even if that's not front of mind, and I am very loath to get into other people's minds, but is there some part of this, Jaime, that is just about getting that vision for the Democratic Party out, taking presidential politics out of it?
Well, it's good for Senator Gallego just to get that national reputation. His gravitas is expanding, and you know, he was always considered to be kind of a bombastic congressman, but since he's run his campaign and become a U.S. senator, his credibility amongst even Republicans has grown significantly because they've seen a much more mature, much more disciplined type of candidate, but also now United States Senator. So if he continues in that mold, then, yeah, I think he could not just help himself, but really help the Democratic Party here in Arizona, because I think having that kind of a base and that kind of structure can help a lot of other candidates down the ticket.
I mean, is that something, Roy, that is on the senator's mind, do you think, in terms of having his vision of the Democratic Party maybe be the one that wins out or is featured maybe more prominently at the end of the day than any of the other sort of competing visions of what the Democratic Party can be?
Well, I think it's less so about, you know, having his vision win out. I think it's more, you know, sharing what he has been able to accomplish and the lessons to be learned from that. And I think that, you know, ultimately, you know, if it results in more Democrats winning, I think that's a good thing, I think, from his perspective nationally and in Arizona, because we get better policies that way. And so I think he's going to go out and sort of share that vision in Iowa and other places. I mean, we're many political lifetimes away from 2028, so yes. Who knows? There'll obviously be a lot of candidates interested. But in the meanwhile, I think the senator is going to go out there and again, share his perspective, which is exactly the kind of perspective I think the Democrats need right now. And again, when we're talking about the Big Beautiful Bill, where, you know, there's devastating impacts to, you know, Medicaid recipients and rural hospitals and, you know, clean energy, you know, I mean, you can go on and on about the different things in ways that this bill is going to devastate working class people. He's going to be able to attack that and articulate why that's bad and why there's a different way.
I mean, let me ask you about the so-called Big Beautiful mm-hmm. Bill. Governor Hobbs just yesterday announced that she will be asking for some federal money from that, from the border security, border barrier component of that, to repay the state for the cost of putting up and then taking down the so-called shipping container border wall that happened under Governor Doug Ducey. Should the governor be holding her breath on getting that big check from the government?
Yes. Well, and people forget, too, it was the reason why we expended about $200 million and then had to take it down was because of the Biden administration. Biden administration sued and said, no, this is actually federal land where you put those containers on, and so you can't do that. And so forcing then-Governor Ducey to take it down. So my question is, well, why wouldn't the governor say, well, reimburse us because of the mistakes that Joe Biden did? We should have just kept it there.
That might be a more compelling argument for the Trump administration, don't you think?
Yeah, you might get the money then.
I mean, is it to some extent, this kind of reminds me in some ways of when former Governor Janet Napolitano would make a big deal about requesting the government to pay the state back for the cost of housing or incarcerating people who are not in this country legally, asking the federal government for money, dealing with border security, dealing with immigration. The state, as far as I know, didn't get any money then for those things. Safe to say, state's probably not going to get money for this now.
I mean, it's hard to say. This administration is sort of impossible to predict, but I think she's just doing right by Arizonans. I mean, I think if there's an opportunity to potentially get some money back, some taxpayer dollars back, why not try? I mean, I think the prior, you know, shipping container wall obviously didn't work. I mean, I thought it was a mistake at the time. I think she did too. And now that that's gone and it was sort of, you know, a waste, it didn't really accomplish anything. Again, if you can get some of the money back, then why not try to do that? And instead, you know, use that kind of money for things that actually work when it comes to border security.
Speaking of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, and you mentioned Medicaid and SNAP, the food stamp program, and some others, how prominently do you think those issues will feature in campaign ads, mailers, campaigns in general for Democrats coming up in 2026?
It'll be a huge issue because when we talk about Medicaid, you know, some of the things the bill does, when it's going to result in people losing their health insurance, it's going to result in rural hospitals either closing or significantly changing their services, SNAP, et cetera. All those things are going to be devastating specific to Arizona. I mean, we're talking about, you know, perhaps over 200,000 people that could lose their Medicaid benefits through access as a result of this bill. And that's before, again, we get into some of the other stuff, like the fact that the bill, you know, is devastating to the deficit, for example, which is something that I think like an Andy Biggs is going to have to answer for as somebody who says he's a deficit hawk but voted for this thing. So I think it's going to be maybe, you know, the number one issue next year when Democrats are trying to attack Republicans over what they voted for.
Jaime, does this put Republicans more on the defensive? Are there ways that they can go on the offensive about the provisions of this
absolutely.
Bill?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that's discounted is the making the 2017 tax cuts permanent.
Yeah.
And I think from a lot of business perspective, a lot of economists' perspective, that they feel that that's very much needed and helpful to our long-term economic growth as a country. But then some of the other things that I'm not so sure it will have that staying power, that the electorate will say those are necessarily bad, particularly, for instance, adding what I consider to be reasonable-ish work requirements for people that are able-bodied to say, look, 20 hours a week, you have to have some kind of employment or some kind of job training or some kind of educational programs or volunteer work. I mean, I think there's ways that the American public would say, you know what, there's reasonableness to that. Like if you're taking these kinds of services, then there's an expectation that, yeah, there should be some kind of way to pay that back. And as it deals with some of the issues around rural hospitals, which I think is real, the addition of a $50 billion as a fund to help augment and help to support any kind of problems rural hospitals will have, I could see that growing. Come next year, in election year, if that becomes a bigger problem than that was anticipated, I think you'll have enough Republicans to say, yeah, that is a big issue for us. So I think if you can deal with those kinds of things, and I think there's definitely time to do that prior to the next election cycle, which is 18 months away, there definitely are ways for the Republicans to mitigate some of the things that they're going to get attacked on.
The time issue is interesting because as you were describing those things, the word that kept coming to my mind is nuance. Like those are kind of nuanced arguments. And as we all know, nuance in political campaigns are not usually a good combination.
That's very true. Especially with the Trump administration, too. They're not very nuanced. They just kind of hit on. Yeah.
Do you buy into what Jaime's selling here in terms of being able to be? I think I know the answer to this, but do you think Democrats will have to answer for some of those, like, the idea of, you know, if you're taking this federal money, maybe there should be some strings attached kind of thing.
I buy a lot of what Jaime usually sells, but not any of that. No, I mean, that is going to be a difficult explanation. And, you know, we think about, for example, like the reference to the Rural Hospital Stabilization Fund that's in there. Well, it's in there because another part of the very same bill eliminates the Medicaid expansion subsidies from Obamacare. And that's why these rural hospitals are going to have these problems. So it's sort of funny to me and ironic to me where you have one section of the bill that's devastating to rural hospitals and then a smaller fund to try to like make up for that. And I look at that and I say, well, why are we doing any of it? I mean, what's the point of doing that?
Hmm.
Similarly, you know, when it comes to some of the qualifications now that are going to be required under Medicaid, this is cynical, but the bill doesn't actually have those requires go into effect until after 2026, right?
Yeah.
So because they don't want anybody, you know, kicked off the rolls, you know, next year. And I think that's because they know that's exactly what's going to happen. And so Democrats are going to have to do a good job, you know, selling or at least arguing for why this is terrible and making the case. And I do think like it's not going to be that difficult because this bill is just so blatantly awful from my perspective.
Interesting. All right, guys, we'll have to leave it there. Roy Herrera, Jaime Molera, thanks to you both for coming in. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a mobile tribute to Frank Lloyd Wright. But first, birth control became legal in the U.S. for married couples in the mid-1960s and a few years later for unmarried people. But today, many are worried about that right being taken away. It's in that context that a new book explores two of the pioneers of the birth control movement, the icon and the idealist. Margaret Sanger, Mary Ware Dennett, and the rivalry that brought birth control to America tells the story of these two women who had many differences but also much in common. Stephanie Gorton is the book's author, and when I spoke with her earlier, I asked how she defines the rivalry between the two women.
I think it's a rivalry of both personalities and policy differences. Margaret Sanger was a really bold and courageous and complicated person. Mary Ware Dennett, like the title suggests, was a bit more of a straightforward and stubborn idealist. I think she always wanted to have some of Sanger's boldness and her talent for stoking outrage and for breaking the law when it was beneficial to the birth control movement. Whereas Sanger always felt really judged by Dennett. Dennett had this much more elite New England background. So in a way, they were both jealous of each other on a personal level. And as time went on, and they each developed their own group within the birth control movement, they were rivals on a political level as well.
What did that do for their ultimate goal here in terms of having two people who seemingly were looking to achieve the same thing, but having different ways to get there and maybe different sort of in the fine details of what they wanted? Maybe that was a little bit different too?
Initially, they definitely very much wanted the same thing. The idea, the overall goal was to make birth control legal for Americans. There was a federal postal censorship law called the Comstock Act, which made it illegal to distribute any information or any methods connected with birth control. Margaret Sanger eventually realized that she would need to make some concessions in order to make legal birth control a reality within her lifetime. So she began building bridges and making alliances with doctors, with leaders in the eugenics movement. These were compromises that Dennett was not so eager to make. Sanger eventually put forward a version of legal birth control that placed access to it firmly within the hands of doctors. So women would only be able to get a diaphragm with a doctor's prescription. Dennett called this a medical monopoly. She didn't like it at all. And I think she rightly saw that poor and rural women would be left out of this great leap forward.
Did that set their movement back at all? I can just imagine, you know, policymakers who maybe weren't so keen on birth control in the first place being able to say, look, these two people who are both advocating for birth control, like, they don't even know what they want. They can't agree on this. How are we supposed to?
Absolutely. I mean, it's something that has so many parallels to activism today. But reading through their congressional lobbying diaries is so fascinating because that was a response that they got very much over and over again. You know, that there are these two competing branches of the movement. And why should we support this cause when you haven't even figured out what you want yet? This was not a topic that was good for politicians to be connected with. So any pretext to delay or to say, well, you know, this needs to be moved along a little further, those pretexts, you know, would be just leaped upon. And then, of course, there's the reality that they were competing for the same pots of money and they were applying to the philanthropists. So that didn't do them any favors either.
Did Sanger and Dennett recognize that their rivalry was maybe not ultimately serving their end goals?
I definitely think that Dennett did, because she wrote quite a few mostly conciliatory letters to Sanger, although she never stopped wanting Sanger to set aside the doctors, what she called the doctors only compromise or the medical monopoly. So she called a couple of times for what she called the joining of forces, that, you know, they should both get behind their original goal, that this should be, you know, a broad effort to legalize birth control, that birth control should be accessible just, you know, on your drugstore shelf. And the review process should be more like an FDA review than an individual doctor, you know, eyeing a patient up and down and deciding whether they were morally worthy of the birth control that they wanted. But they never, you know, they never came close to it. Instead, unfortunately, there was a lot of sniping at each other in the press.
One of the things you write about that I wanted to get into with you a little bit is why you think it is that Sanger is so much more well-known than Dennett.
That's a really interesting question. And I think, honestly, a big part of it is that she just lived a lot longer. She lived through the late 1960s, long enough to be on the radio quite frequently and to even appear on TV. Dennett died in the 40s. And she was also just a much more private person.
What kind of lessons or parallels do you take from the stories of these two women to sort of the issues going on today, not just with reproductive rights, but I guess sort of activism in general?
I really think this is a big part of what I got out of the book and out of the research. One of the most surprising things that came out of it is that activism is a really long game. There are very few instances of neat linear progress. You know, Dennett returned to Congress for 5 grueling years each session and felt she had made no headway at all because her bill kept getting rejected. But in a way, she laid the groundwork for everything that came next. So she, you know, she did, she was, I argue, a real visionary for being the first person to take such an essential and, you know, taboo issue to Washington, really. I also think there's just, you know, there's something to be said for finding some way to collaborate between leaders in a movement, even if their visions are so far apart. There has to be some conciliation and some way to work together so that their conversations with elected leaders and their funding doesn't get as split up and as scattered as it got with the birth control movement.
Well, it seems like that kind of goes to the issue of compromise, right? Because it sounds like, you know, Sanger was willing to make compromises that Dennett just simply was not. And that kind of precluded them from getting together and working as a unified force in any meaningful way, at least, you know, for a decent part of both of their activist careers.
Yes, they're two extremely flawed and complicated personalities. And, you know, the fact that they were so unable to work together is a good example on the personal level. And of course, Sanger's infamous allegiance to the eugenics movement is a big part of the story also.
I'm also interested in the fact that, you know, we've been talking about how different these two people were. But as you write, they also had a decent amount of stuff in common, right?
Yes, their lives really intersected in some bizarrely similar ways. You know, they both married and later divorced architects. They each had three children and lost one of their children young. You know, they ended up in downtown Manhattan, moving in the same circles. And of course, both of them sort of felt wholly, entirely dedicated to the birth control movement. So it's really interesting that there are these intersections in their lives, and yet they felt this rivalry, this contest with each other, really a jealousy of each other, I think.
All right. That is Stephanie Gorton, author of the book, The Icon and the Idealist, Margaret Sanger, Mary Ware Dennett, and the Rivalry That Brought Birth Control to America. Stephanie, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Legendary architect Frank Lloyd Wright is known for many iconic building designs here in the Valley, from Taliesin West to Gamage Auditorium. And now, a forgotten Wright sketch for a food truck, of all things, has inspired a collaboration with Airstream Camp Trailers. The show's Sativa Peterson recently spoke with Andrew P. Collins, executive director of The Drive. She began by asking, what exactly does Wright's mobile kitchen design look like?
Yeah, for sure. It looks like basically like an old truck from the 1930s, except the back is more almost like a railroad car. You know, not dissimilar from food trucks we have today. Plans for it were an artifact that I guess must have been at the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation out in Arizona. The vehicle was never built, so this was just kind of like a back of napkin idea that he must have had at one point. And I guess not much is known about like whether or not it was commissioned by a company or just something he had dreamed up. But yeah, it was a pretty simple truck design, two axles on the back, had a little kitchen, and it had a cooktop like with a bunch of different burners, like a water tank storage unit. And yeah, kind of his signature, like very, very sharp lines, kind of smooth design on the exterior.
The concept was sketched by Wright in 1939.
That got me thinking, like, that would have been near the end of the Great Depression. I wondered if that had anything to do with it, you know, how he might have intended for it to be used if it had been built.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it certainly wouldn't have been a time where, you know, maybe not a lot of people were going out to restaurants. So that might have been a good way to, I don't know, increase accessibility to different types of food. Maybe it could be a good way for somebody to get a business off the ground. You know, Frank Lloyd Wright was all about the making the most of small spaces with some of his like Houstonian ideas. And so that could have been a great way to make the most of the small footprint of a vehicle.
All of this begs the question, was Wright inspired by Airstream? The company released its first factory-made silver travel trailer in 1936, right around the same time Wright arrived in the Sonoran Desert, and 3 years before he sketched that food truck design. Again, Andrew P. Collins.
Yeah, there definitely would have been some overlap between Frank Lloyd Wright's career and Airstream being around. It's, you know, his whole thing was oneness with nature and being having a structure look at home wherever it was. And when you look at like a classic Airstream trailer, it really does look at home in sort of any like exterior environment. It's such a quintessential shape. So yeah, maybe it does kind of fit his principles.
This new vehicle, officially called the Airstream Frank Lloyd Wright Usonian Limited Edition Travel Trailer, takes these two ideas from nearly 100 years ago and incorporates them into a high-end mashup, combining the aesthetics of Airstream with Wright's architectural principles.
So the exterior is a pretty classic Airstream. You know, they kind of look like a chrome caterpillar, so to speak. But the inside has a lot of his, like, signature, kind of like the dark wood that he uses, a lot of really nice, clean, straight lines. And a big part of it is kind of consistent with the Frank Lloyd Wright principle of kind of bringing the outdoors to the indoors. Of course, that's like pretty endemic to any sort of camper vehicle, but this one in particular has like a nice big big opening rear door in the back that like basically lets the bedroom be right into the outdoors. So it's got that coinciding with nature that was obviously big with Frank Lloyd Wright.
The limited edition trailer is 28 feet long and sleeps four, but don't expect a Depression-era price tag. With clean lines, warm wood-tone cabinets, a wood-slatted lighting panel, and desert-hued decor, the vehicle will set you back $185,000, kind of making us wonder if Frank Lloyd Wright had ever heard of glamping. That was Andrew P. Collins, Executive Director of The Drive, speaking with the show's Sativa Peterson. Crimson Sparkles got her start in the drag scene by doing makeup for other performers when she was in high school in Colorado. But she had to hide her love of drag from her conservative family. It was just one of the ways she often felt like she couldn't be her full self. Crimson is also a trans woman, and from the time she was about 8 years old, she knew there was something different about her. My co-host Sam Dingman spoke with her earlier this year.
I was confused why, like, people constantly asked me if I was a boy or a girl. I always, like, on the inside, thought that I was a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, like, brought that up with, like, my family. I was like, why am I always being like asked if I'm a boy or a girl? I thought I was a girl. And at the time I was playing with Barbies and whatnot. And then my family threw all of them away and bought me Batman toys and made me to where could only play with stereotypical boy toys. I wasn't allowed to like do dance anymore. I was pulled from anything mildly feminine and was forced to like do like track or basketball and stuff like that.
Wow. So they really rejected.
Yeah.
Ultimately, of course, you were able to come out. How were you able to find your way to that point, and how did drag play a role in that?
So I was sent to a conversion camp in Kentucky for a little bit. I had like a shaved head, and I was very like masculine presenting because I had to, and I immediately was like, I'm a trans woman, I kind of need to like get that off my chest. And that's how I met Chantel Sparkles and Ethan Cross, who are my drag parents.
This was at the conversion camp?
It was outside of it.
Outside of it, okay.
I pretty much lied to get out, but Ethan and Chantel welcomed me with like open arms, and they're basically like my second parents, if that makes sense, like the parents that
certainly
kind of accepted me.
So you met them in Kentucky?
Yeah.
Once you got out of the camp?
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds like it was a very delicate time for you. What did they say that helped you step into your true self?
I think they kind of knew when they first met me that I was trans. We did a few photo shoots together, and they saw how I lit up, and I felt like myself, and I was comfortable.
What kind of photo shoots? Like drag-related photo shoots?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It must have been a very profound experience to have them just recognize your truth.
Yeah, it was, they don't know it, but like the first time I met them and we did like a photo shoot and everything, I like drove home crying, like in like a good way, because it was the first time anyone in my life like accepted me and like told me it was, like, okay to, like, be expressive for like the longest time. Up until like recently, I would constantly apologize for like literally everything.
So you meet them and eventually you end up back in Colorado Springs, right?
Yeah. That's how I met Daniel Ashton. He worked at Club Q as a bartender, just a very positive influence to like all the like weirdos. And if you didn't have like a family, you had one when you met him. He like helped me like get on HRT. He helped me find like all these.
Tell folks what HRT is.
HRT is hormone replacement therapy. It's like either like testosterone blockers and like estrogen, or estrogen blockers and testosterone.
If it doesn't feel too painful to talk about, what happened to Daniel?
So on November 20th, an active shooter entered Club Q.
This was in 2022?
Yes. And he passed away protecting the door girl. And
from the active shooter?
Yes. And I was recovering from a surgery at the time, which I was supposed to be there that night. And because of like that whole ordeal, I got terrified to like do drag or to present myself in the way I wanted to be presented. And so I kind of stopped doing drag basically completely. I started like masking myself when I had to go out in public.
Like as in presenting in a more masculine way?
And eventually I was like forced to like realize that the longer I stayed in Colorado, I was not going to like either survive because of how other people are treating me or because of how I was feeling about myself. And so I basically, as soon as I had enough money, I abruptly moved to Phoenix.
When you got up to perform again for the first time after taking this time off, do you remember what the performance was? How did it feel to do it?
My first performance back was Rhinestone Heart by Slater. I was extremely like anxious and nervous during the number, but as soon as it ended, like I walked backstage and everyone was like congratulating me and saying that I did amazing and that I was a great entertainer. And in like in my head, I was just like always nitpicking myself and like pointing out what I did wrong. And they were like more so looking at like what I did right was drastically outweighing, and that I was the only one noticing what I did wrong. And that I was just like overthinking a lot.
Sure. When you do drag, you do drag as Crimson Sparkles.
Yes, I do.
Since we're on the radio and people can't see you, would you be willing to describe your ensemble today in the studio?
So I made this black like Lolita doll type of look. It's out of like pre-quilted black velvet fabric. I'm wearing black polka dot gloves and these AB like Aurora Borealis jewelry set. My drag mother Chantel Sparkles also has a wig business who made my hair, which is like a giant finger waved like old Hollywood type of style.
Yeah, and you also have a crescent moon, I think it is, under your right eye. What's the significance of that?
So the underlining meaning towards that is there was many times when I did like live with family or whatever, that at night was when I would like wake up briefly for like an hour or two, get like secretly do makeup and do my hair and post a picture, and then I would take it all off. And so it like signifies that like I got to be myself pretty much at like night.
So you would wake up in the middle of the night, get in a full face of makeup, put on whatever clothes and jewelry and wigs you had, just to feel like yourself for like a few hours in the middle of the night?
Yep.
Well, if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like there's a little bit more of an opportunity to feel like yourself now.
Yeah, just a little bit.
I'm really glad to hear that. If you'd be comfortable saying, you know, obviously this is a very fraught time for people in the trans community. Is it something you focus on a lot? Is it something you try not to think about?
Since that's pretty much all I knew all my like life, it's a lot easier for me to deal with than other people. How I view it is that how people act is a reflection of themselves and not a reflection of how you are on the outside. I strongly encourage that if you're going to be out and loud, which you should, to take self-defense classes.
Have you taken self-defense classes?
Yes, I have. Martial arts or how to shoot a gun and everything. I don't own one, but if I find myself in a situation where one is around me, I would know how to use it. I have pepper spray. I have like all these sorts of things that in case something does happen, I can do something about it.
Well, I hope that you don't have to. And thank you for sharing your story with us, really.
That was Crimson Sparkles. My co-host Sam Dingman spoke with her while she was living in Phoenix. Since that interview first aired, she's changed her drag name to Starlight Sparkles and moved back to Louisville, Kentucky to work for the drag costume designer Ethan M. Cross. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram. It is, no doubt, a very cool follow. We are at KJZZ The Show. And if you feel like 1 hour every weekday just isn't enough of the show and you want more of us, especially in your inbox, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter. It is called Radio Heads. It will come your way every single Thursday right after the show. A little something different, maybe an extra information from an interview subject or notes from members of our team, along with some lovely illustrations. You can sign up for Radioheads at theshow.kjzz.org. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, the news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.
And here and now, coming up next, right here on 91.5 KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Beatitudes Campus, celebrating its 60-year anniversary of serving Arizona seniors. You can experience the community and people at an upcoming event. More at beatitudescampus.org/events.